Totally Football Show. It's international break time and not a moment too soon. As Euro 2020 qualifiers begin, today's show looks at the side they're all talking about, England. There's the word on world champions France, their game with Moldova. Italy, are they turning up for this one? And Germany-Netherlands, we get the scoop with Simon Cooper on whether it's still football against the enemy and how we should be pronouncing Virgil van Dijk. Plus your questions, and we step on more butterflies with a flip reverse it trip back through time. All this in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Rhythm is a dancer. 90s beat poet Snap in full effect on this Totally Football Show, in which we're joined by Duncan Alexander.
Hi, James.
I think you're the reason we're playing that, aren't you?
I am indeed.
All right.
But we'll find out why.
September 92. Oof. Julien Laurent, were you born in September 92?
Yes, I was just 1 month short of my 12th birthday.
All right, Julien Laurent. A little bit of trivia. He's French, but he doesn't like to talk about it. James Horncastle also with us today. And you're getting excited about a game with Finland?
Yeah.
And loads more.
It's not how you start, it's how you finish, James.
Hey, that's true, that's true. It's International Week, of course. There is so much to get us excited about. Euro 2020 qualifiers, by the time you hear this, probably Northern Ireland will have kicked off against Estonia. Scotland might be underway against Kazakhstan.
They've changed the name of the capital.
Of Kazakhstan?
Yeah.
What was it before?
It was Astana.
Of course.
Which everyone knows. But now it is Nur-Sultan after the president who unexpectedly resigned this week. It's quite a big gesture for people that make signposts, if nothing else.
Well, yeah, also because Astana isn't just the name of the capital city, but it's become a brand of a sporting brand.
It's a football club, it's a cycling team.
Yeah.
So at the Milan-San Remo this weekend, we'll have Nur-Sultan. Is that it?
Well, who knows, yeah.
Anyway, Scotland, good luck finding the stadium then. The maps will be worthless. Anyway, loads of games, luckily, to be played, and some very big ones, not least England against the Czech Republic at Wembley. Duncan, before we go too much further, this is all about Euro 2020. How does what's just happened with the Nations League, how does that tie in with this?
So I've actually looked at this week. It's been compelling. The Nations League essentially acts as a mechanism so big teams can't leave Europe, which seems apt. And basically, if you finish in the top two of your group, the qualifying group which kicks off this week, you are definitely going to Euro 2020. And if you look at the groups, maybe the Germany-Holland group, you know, could be tricky. But other than that, you'd imagine all the big teams will get through. And then if they don't, wherever you came in the Nations League last year, that will give you a playoff berth. So,
for example, Scotland...
Yeah.
Do have, if they don't qualify from their group, they do have a playoff berth waiting because of their record in the Nations League.
Exactly. So it kind of takes the pressure off a lot of teams, and it also means that we shouldn't really get any shocks next year.
Even Italy.
Even Italy. All right, OK. Well, we'll talk about Italy later on. Jules, we'll talk about France too, if you fancy it.
Yeah, definitely.
Because there's been all sorts of craziness happening there.
Yeah.
Rabiot's mum weighing in, Griezmann launching his I Am A Legend video.
Yeah, and rings. It's a lot about rings this week as well.
Oh, yeah. Paul Pogba made rings?
Mm-hmm. Well, he bought them.
Commissioned them. OK. Excellent. Take a look at Paul Pogba's ring later on then. First of all, what the world wants to know about most is England.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Free your minds and voices, lift your hands and join us. You can feel it in the air. You can feel it in the air. England preparing another campaign. Now, in pods, we tend to always start with England because, well, England. But this time around, they're genuinely one of the most exciting stories out there. That plucky side that won hearts and lots of set pieces at the World Cup and then did ever so well at the Nations League as well. And we'll be... continuing that adventure in June, now unveiling a new generation. What an exciting squad, James.
Yeah, I think there's still a freshness to this team, a sense of a progress building from the World Cup, be it the change of system, be it that win against Spain, the come-from-behind win against Croatia as well. And you look at some of the new components of this team with Declan Rice coming in. And talk about that front three, which seems to be set with Kane, Rashford and Sterling. But the players behind them, in the pecking order, you know, Callum Hudson-Odoi, Jadon Sancho as well. I think there's a lot to be excited about if you're an England fan.
Absolutely. Scary stat here, courtesy of Jack Pitbrook. There's now only one player in the England squad who was actually born in the 80s. There are as many players who were born in the 2000s. In fact, I think there might be more now. Callum Hudson-Odoi
joining from the under-21s. Yeah,
yeah. So
Hudson-Odoi was actually born after Wembley got knocked down, which is emotional. The old Wembley.
Absolutely. That's extraordinary, isn't it? And the videos from training of Jadon Sancho destroying Harry Maguire and all that. Jules, give us an objective view on this England squad.
I would be disappointed if Jadon Sancho didn't start on Friday, I have to say. I know Rashford, Sterling and Kane have done really well, especially in that first half away in Spain, not so much in the second half, but in that first half. And it's probably unbalanced or too hard to play them all four together. So I don't know, maybe like a 4-4-2 formation with Sterling on the left, Sancho on the right, and Kane and Rashford up front, or even Kane a bit behind Rashford, and then Declan Rice or another pure defensive midfielder and someone next to him as well, whoever that may be. But I would really love to see Jadon Sancho starting that game. I think he deserves it. I think he's in the form of his life, and why not starting? We had that debate in France the 2 seasons before the World Cup about Kylian Mbappe, and I think there's a lot of similarities, although they're two different players, but between Mbappe and Sancho. And there was a lot of people in France in the debate who were saying, like, he's too young, give him the time, he doesn't need to be starting at the World Cup, blah, blah, blah. And it was pretty obvious for the other half of the country that talent doesn't wait for the age, you know. And I think if Sancho is at that level right now, which he's shown all season with Borussia Dortmund, I think he would deserve a place in that team.
Mm. Duncan, you're going along on Friday.
Mm, with producer Ben, so we'll cast a beady eye on what's going on. But I mean, I take Jules' point there, but I think England do have a lot of riches up front. I think Rice playing in midfield is probably the biggest change that Southgate hopefully will make, because if there was a weak part of England at the World Cup, it was the midfield. And Rice, you know, it really does look like the real deal. He'll be the first player with Rice in his surname to play for England since Charles Moe Rice back in England's first ever match in 1872.
So that's an extraordinary gap.
Yeah.
Is Rice a common name in England? More common than
potato and pasta, which sounds stupid, but I did actually look up once, and there are a couple of people with the surname Potato.
Who played for England?
They've never played for England, but maybe one day.
What other foodstuffs, Duncan, because I know you've looked this up, have played for England?
I don't know.
Have you not looked that up?
I haven't looked that up.
I can't believe that you checked potato and pasta.
Lasagna.
There was a Patrick Berger for the Czech Republic, and of course, as you say, lasagna.
But never played for Italy, right?
Well, he's in
the squad.
Oh, yeah, he's in the squad. That's right.
I think he has played.
Imagine Rice against lasagna. I mean, that would be...
Absolute carb classico for me.
Yeah. What were we talking about? Oh, yeah, so England, the question marks, if anywhere... surely must be at the back, where you've got the excitable Everton keeper Jordan Pickford, Michael Keane, who's not really had a great season, and various players who've withdrawn, like Luke Shaw, John Stones. Also, did you see Czech Republic striker Matej Vidra out of Burnley saying that England's defence, and in particular Harry Maguire, can be exploited? He said that's what Burnley did. Big talk for a nation that finished 4 points behind Northern Ireland in the World Cup qualifying. But
slabhead. Well, I mean, look, ultimately, England's first choice defence, should everyone be fit, centre-back, will be John Stones and Joe Gomez. So I think it's just in this case that you've got Maguire, Tarkowski and Keane. Yeah, in terms of depth, backup, they're serviceable. And we saw what Maguire can do at the World Cup, his effectiveness from set pieces. You know, really, with this Czech Republic side, who have Vidra, who's been sort of, you know, jobbing it around the championship and being sort of a backup striker in Premier League clubs down the bottom of the table, and Patrick Schick, who's done okay with his country, scored the winner in both games against Slovakia in the Czech Republic-Slovakia kind of derby. I think that trio, although it'd be only two of the three, should be able to cope pretty well with this Czech front line.
Okay. Czechs, just one of the rivals we're facing in Group A, The other nations being Bulgaria, Kosovo and Montenegro. Duncan, they enjoyed a 1-0 win over Poland's side, which featured Lewandowski. And then also they beat Slovakia. I think that was away. That was the end of 2018. So coming off a decent pair of results, Duncan.
Yeah, I think the slightly disappointing thing is that I think I wasn't overly convinced before the Nations League started about it, but what was good about it was that teams were playing their peers, if you like. Right. You know, England were playing Croatia, they were playing Spain, and we've now gone back to, admittedly, a shorter qualifying period, but it's still a lot of kind of games where England are going to have, you know, 70% possession at home and make a lot of passes and probably win 3-0.
I see. There are six players from Slavia Prague in the Czech squad, which is interesting because they've just knocked Sevilla out of the Europa League. Other Czech facts include the statistic that they're the number one beer-drinking country in the world, 160 litres per capita. But Schick's the star name, James. How dangerous will he be, do you think, for the likes of Maguire?
Well, I think he's done better for his country than he has for his club in recent times. He obviously went from Sampdoria to Roma for €42 million about 18 months ago, which was the biggest signing in Roma's history, beating the investment that they made for Gabriel Batistuta back in 2000. I think it's never been quite an easy fit for Schick at Roma because they don't play a system that gets the best out of him. But Claudio Ranieri has certainly tried to make him a part of the first team at Roma, playing two up front with Dzeko and Schick.
With his nation, though, it is...
Yeah, I think he's done pretty well, as I mentioned. And in the Slovakia games, which are big games for the Czech Republic, he scored the winner in both of those matches. And he's a very technically gifted, elegant footballer. I remember when he was coming through in that season at Sampdoria, some of his skills were reminiscent of Bergkamp. You know, ability to go past players, link the play, invent something out of nothing. So, yeah, I think he would certainly be the player that England will have... Well, yeah, he'll be the main feature of their opposition analysis.
I see. This one of only two games that England will have to prepare for the Nations League finals in Portugal, the other one being Montenegro on Monday.
Who don't have Jovetic or Vucinic anymore. Not maybe the Montenegro that... once posed a threat to get into major tournaments, but never did.
Yeah. Speaking of Monday night, by the way, breaking news, Duncan, our trip to Liverpool has been postponed. If you were due to be coming to see us at the Epstein Theatre on Monday, unfortunately, they rescheduled the show for I think, November. You'll get a full refund and be contacted by the theatre, and we'll get back to you when it's actually going to happen. Which means we can all sit around and watch England-Montenegro.
Woohoo!
Hi, I'm Rodri Giggs. You probably know me for being related to a famous sports star. That's right, my dad did play rugby for Wales. I've always lived a loyal life, always use the same brand of tea bags. I always drink in the same pub.
Hey, mate, what does he do, mate?
And always support my country.
A huge defeat for Wales. Questions will be asked of the manager.
Questions will be asked. You see, loyalty gets you nowhere. Live for rewards instead. That's why I'm Paddy's Rewards Club Ambassador.
Paddy Power's Rewards Club. Loyalty's dead. Live for rewards. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
Super, that was a crackling part. Let's try and maintain that intensity. All right, okay. Let's dial it up to 11 now, folks, as we detail what awaits the likes of Scotland, Wales, Ireland and, yes, Northern Ireland over the next week or so. Scotland, who've won promotion, of course, in the Nations League to the second tier, which means they've got that playoff semi-final place in their back pocket. If they don't get through the group... That's good news, isn't it? Because is it a tough group? It's got Belgium and Russia, who face each other this weekend. Also Cyprus, San Marino and Kazakhstan, or whatever they're called now. Their entire squad, Scotland, I'm reading here, only has 9 goals internationally between them.
Yeah, scoring goals. Yeah, it's not... hasn't been easy, I think, for them to come. They also have a problem at left-back because Robertson and Tierney are both out for this game. It's just they have a good young generation coming through. They've put the last few years, they've put a lot of effort and money into youth teams, youth system, especially for the Scotland youth teams. And they've got a very good generation coming through. Whether they have the right head coach in place for them, I'm not so sure. And they will also need results. But if they could qualify for the Euros, whatever way, and it looks that, you know, maybe the playoffs would be because as you said, it's a tough group, would be their way. That experience would be really, you know, I think priceless for, especially for the younger ones.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess Scotland will look towards Ryan Fraser. He's been obviously very effective in the Premier League this season. He's got a goal and three assists in his last two games for Scotland. So, I mean, if he turns up, then they should be okay. I mean, I think maybe the fact that they know that they've got that playoff as a reserve could allow them to play a bit with a bit more freedom in the group. And, you know, you never know what's going to happen between Belgium and Russia. You know, they could drop points where we don't expect.
Exactly. Wales had a 1-0 win, a scrappy 1-2 over Trinidad and Tobago at the evocative surroundings of the racecourse in Wrexham, which is the oldest existing stadium to stage international football. It hosted Wales' first home match in March 1877. Did you know that, Duncan?
I did, actually. Yeah.
This was with Gareth Bale and Aaron Ramsey, right?
Charlie Mo Rice played there for England.
He only ever played once for England, and then he became a stockbroker.
Is that right?
Classic path for me.
Okay. There was no Bale nor Ramsey in the lineup against Trinidad and Tobago, but they're expected to be taking the field when Wales host Slovakia on Sunday. That group, this is the Slovakians, also Croatia. It's quite a tough group, this, isn't it? Hungary and Azerbaijan. Huh. Ireland were New Hope. They begin life under Mick McCarthy.
A new hope.
A new hope. Exciting.
No.
Exciting new dawn.
They're away at Gibraltar, and then they're home to Georgia. Keane is in his backroom team. Robbie Keane, that is. If you're curious, James, about who else is in the group alongside Gibraltar and Georgia, the Irish will also be facing Switzerland and Denmark, who are potentially more arduous adversaries.
Well, Gibraltar and Georgia are rocking a hard place, you might say.
Hey. Yeah.
That is good. That's very good.
When Mick McCarthy got the job, he celebrated at the restaurant at the Hamyard Hotel in Soho. And we were supposed, me and my wife, to have dinner with our friends, except that we forgot. And our friends called that night saying like, oh, sorry, we'll be late. And we were literally in our pyjamas with our children in our house. So we had to get ready quickly, get the babysitter in. And then got to the restaurant and Mick McCarthy was still there and celebrating. And our friends got really excited that Mick McCarthy was there when we were not there, for example.
Wow.
We don't have an anecdote of the season award yet. But that's incredible. And anything else about that night, Jules?
We made it an hour late.
Yeah.
We just completely forgot it was in the diary. He's been there for a long time.
Jules' friends, if you're listening
John and
to
Anna,
this,
sorry,
that's
John
how
and
much
Anna.
You matter.
John listens to our pods every week. I apologise again. It was a lovely, lovely evening. We were just an hour late.
And Mick, was he particularly vocal in his celebrations?
Yeah, with his family. So John told us. He was the day he got the news that he got the job and everything. So I guess we were part a bit of Mick's happiness, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Ireland's squad, they're four strikers. 14 caps and one goal between them. Talking about scoring goals being an issue, that doesn't sound too comforting. I'm sure Irish fans will be delighted to have turned that managerial page. Northern Ireland, who didn't win any of their Nation League games and were relegated, of course, have gone and got themselves drawn in a group with Germany and the Netherlands. Yikes. They don't have a playoff in their back pocket, do they, Duncan?
They don't, unless some odd results happen, no.
Oh, could they have one?
Well, it kind of cascades down. It's a bit like every second counts, the old Paul Daniels vehicle. But, they've got to get through this group pretty much, and they're not going to. But good luck to them.
Right, no Will Grigg.
No.
He's not on fire anymore.
No, he's out.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in a very real sense. All right, well, tell you what, speaking of Germany and the Netherlands, remember how their miserable 2018 probably had its nadir in that 3-0 defeat in Amsterdam?
They know! Zien we hem zelf doen in Oranje. Schitterend gedaan, Jorginho Wijnaldum. Dat zit dus allemaal in je. Dat zit allemaal in je.
Well, with 2019 already not off to the best of starts for German football, guess who they've got this weekend?
Netherlands.
That's right, again. Jules. Who, by the way, are enjoying a fine time of it. Did brilliantly in the Nations League. Ajax flying in the Champions League. We decided then to dial up Simon Cooper, who quite literally wrote the book on the German-Dutch rivalry, to ask how much they'll be looking forward to this clash in the Netherlands and where their own current resurgence has come from.
I mean, firstly, it's just
an unexpected generation of players emerged quite suddenly. Ronald Koeman became manager of Holland about a year ago, and he says he hadn't expected then all these players to suddenly come through. So you have Matthijs de Ligt, who's 19, you know, the Ajax captain, regular centre-back partner of Virgil van Dijk, who, as you know, has been the best player in the Premier League this season. And van Dijk has really come from nowhere very fast. I mean, 5 years ago, he wasn't even picked for the World Cup 2014. He was a very average player then, and he just gets better every month. So you have these two amazing centre-backs. You have Frenkie de Jong in the centre of midfield, who's a guy who can dribble from the back of midfield and keeps advancing the ball. And also just Holland have adopted a what you might call vertical football again, where you move the ball forward quickly. You know, when you win the ball, the opposition's out of position. You very quickly pass forward, you have players running into space, which sounds obvious, but the Dutch didn't do that for years. They played this very kind of slow horizontal game of kind of endless possessions, sideways, square balls. And so I'd say it's the tactical plus the sudden generation, other players beyond the ones I've just mentioned as well.
Simon, back in the dark days of 2017, you said that Dutch football had become something of an old boys network. So what is Koeman doing different, and how significant is it that Van Gaal has retired?
I mean, Van Gaal was the last Dutch coach still operating at top level, but it's true the game had started to leave him behind. I would name the Ajax coach Erik ten Hag and the previous but one Ajax coach Peter Bos, who's now at Leverkusen in Germany. Bos helped get them to the Europa League final 2 years ago. Ten Hag coached them to some marvellous performances, not just against Real Madrid, but also against Bayern Munich and Benfica this year. And what you see is that these coaches are very influenced by German football, because kind of Germany became the new Holland, where they played this very rapid, forward-moving style with gegenpressing, where you press opponents the second you lose the ball. And that's what Ajax do. The Dutch national team, not so much, but it's also plays much quicker. I mean, Koeman is absolutely a guy who is very interested in the latest in international football. So the Dutch national team is more counter-attacking, but they do that again very rapidly. You know, Koeman, to his credit, has always kind of stayed in touch with what the Spaniards and the English and the Germans are doing. He was really the only Dutch coach of his generation who stayed at top level. And, you know, there's a new thinking. That's what happens when you lose for years. You start to think, well, actually, maybe we don't know how to do it. Let's look around. And the Dutch are lucky that their neighbours, the Germans and the Belgians, and just, you know, 2 hours' drive, the French, are the best national teams in the world. So it's a very easy place to go looking for best practice from.
So a 3-0 win over Germany in the Nations League at home, and then a 2-2 draw away, and here they come again. How keenly will this fixture now be felt in the Netherlands?
I mean, it's actually, the Dutch now really like the Germans in football, in politics, everywhere. So, you know, when I wrote Football Against the Enemy 25 years ago, there were these obsessions with the Germans linked to World War II still. A genuine dislike of Germany. And that doesn't exist in the Netherlands anymore. And in football, actually, in recent World Cups, many Dutch people have supported Germany, which sounds very weird. But, you know, this is the way we're going. The Dutch have kind of realized again that they are very like the Germans. They're cousins or mini Germans. And in football, you see that as well. And of course, Germany in football is not the kind of ugly, lucky, defensive, physical team that they were 25 years ago. They're, you know, although they failed at the World Cup last year, they do try to play beautiful football. So the Germans learned from the Dutch, and then the Dutch began learning from the Germans, which is the way you stay at the top. You have to kind of look at the people doing it best and copy them. That's also what Gareth Southgate's England aspires to do.
There you go. Quick chat there with Simon Cooper, kind of mini Cooper slot. And you can read more of him, if you like, in the FT. Germany, of course, got relegated thanks to the Dutch efforts to Pool B of the Nations League. They've only had one competitive win in the last year. That was that last-minute win against Sweden. No teams in the Champions League quarterfinals.
For the first time in 13 years or something like that.
Leroy Sané's back in just in time to be at the wrong end of a very nasty-looking tackle in their midweek 1-1 draw with Serbia.
Did you see his outfit as well when he turned up for the Germany training camp?
I didn't see it, Jules. What did it look like?
So he had the Balenciaga wool coat where they painted on. That was worth £4,000.
Okay. What's painted on?
So on the coat,
yeah.
So it's made of wool,
right?
Nice fluffy wool, and they painted on it, and that's by his own is only worth £4,000. He had a big Louis Vuitton bag that's worth 18k, and then his trainers, which were Nike Off-Whites, were £2,000
right.
A pair. So he shocked a lot of people that his whole outfit was worth around £25,000 for him to travel
right.
To Germany.
Okay, this edition of Get the Look
Get the look by from Leroy Sané.
What's wrong with an Umbro training top?
Well, quite. Of course, there have been big changes to the German outfit. They've cleared out all the veterans like Hummels and Müller and Boateng. Very interesting to see if that...
Haven't cleared out Jürgen Löw, though.
No, they haven't, have they?
Maybe it's about time they did.
It's clinging on. I don't think they played badly against Serbia. I have to say the second half was better than the first half.
Oh, you watched the game, Jules?
Yeah.
Tell us more. How's the new look team going?
It was quite a young team. I still think that defensively, Süle, Ginter are not good enough for me to go far. They're certainly not nowhere near as good as Hummels and Boateng could have, or were at their peak. So I think defensively, and we saw that in the goal they conceded with Luka Jovic is on his own after a corner. And there was two more big chances for Serbia as well. Ter Stegen came on at halftime for Neuer. I don't know how Neuer started that game, but it's a no-brainer. I think that Ter Stegen should be the starting goalkeeper in that team. But when Rose especially came on, I thought he made a big difference. I like obviously the youth that they try to bring in. I wouldn't play Timo Werner up front. I would rather them try something else, whether that's even someone like Mario Götze in the false number nine. But I don't think he works with Werner there, to be fair, and he missed two big chances yesterday. But there was still, I think, a lot of positive things, especially in that second half. Goretzka took his goal very well, and they had loads of chances. They could have won the game 4-1 or 4-2 easily as well. So I don't think it's all bad for a first game in 2019. But the Dutch would be a far tougher opponent than Serbia, where even if Serbia played actually quite good football at times.
Okay. That's going to be the game of the weekend, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
Right. France, who got beaten 2-0 by the Netherlands in that Nations League run. You're away at Moldova on Friday, Jules, and then you're home to Iceland.
Yeah, on Monday.
Okay, what's your recent record like against the Icelanders?
Yeah, we obviously smashed them at the Euros 2016 after they beat England.
Yeah,
so
but more recently, Jules?
Smashed the ice.
It was more difficult in a friendly game in Guingamp.
2-2 draw.
Season 2-2, where Kylian Mbappe came off the bench to save a draw for the World Cup champions.
Right, okay. It's an easy group, this, though, isn't it? I know there are no easy games at this level, but Iceland, Turkey, Andorra, Moldova and Albania.
Yeah, I mean, Deschamps, I thought, was good this weekend. So were the players, by saying it's always hard to go again, I think, after winning a Euros or a World Cup. I think that's why Spain in that generation was so incredible. But I think he's been quite good after the Nations League disappointment, because France thought that they were going to qualify for the semi-final and a very last-minute goal from Virgil van Dijk.
Thank you, Simon.
Exactly. Prevented them from qualifying. But I think Pogba said yesterday that the players were tired after the World Cup, the whole stress and everything that had happened in that summer. And maybe it was not a bad thing in the end not to go through for the Nations League quarters, because I think it was a bit of a warning sign. And I think he sort of re-energised them a little bit for this Euro campaign.
Any surprises in the squad, Jules, or can we just crack on?
I mean, quickly, just because I had a lot of questions on Twitter.
Oh,
people, why is Laporte not in that squad? Uh-huh. And why is even Longley, who is having a great season with Barcelona, not in the squad? And I'm sure we talked about it before, but I make it quick. Deschamps is not stupid and he's not blind. He knows how good Laporte is and how good Longley is and how they've been good this season with their respective clubs. There's two very important things for Deschamps. The first one is the seniority.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that if you've been part of that team and that squad for a long time, you get a head start towards other players. So for him, Umtiti and Kimpembe, because they were there at the World Cup and in Umtiti's case at the Euros as well, they have some sort of priority, if you want, over others who were not there, because they're used to the squad, they know the code, they know the way that everything works, etc. Yeah. And the other one is he would only take two left-footed centre-backs in his squad, not three, not four. So the two right now, Kimpembe and Umtiti. We saw in November when Umtiti was injured that Mamadou Sakho was picked ahead of Laporte and Longley. So there's clearly a clear hierarchy for him in centre-back, left-footed centre-backs. So I'm sure Laporte and Longley at times will have a chance, maybe if that meant that Kimpembe and Umtiti, for example, have to be injured for them to go in, and then they will have a chance. But that's why they're not there. And also, when Laporte was part of that squad, because he's been called up before, which is not Longley's case, but in Laporte's case, Deschamps felt that his social skills, to put it that way, were not very good. He's a loner. He's always been quite a lonely guy, to be fair, not really integrating with the rest of the squad. And Deschamps didn't really like that.
Deschamps has shown him the door, which is ironic because
the door is closed right now for him, to be fair.
His name, you know. Adrien Rabiot, his mum. Adrien Rabiot's mum versus PSG. Who wins?
Yeah. I think it's a tight contest, to be fair. She's not happy, and Rabiot is not happy that he's been put aside, if you want, by PSG, and probably quite illegally as well, because he's done nothing wrong. Now, I think PSG are trying to use the fact that he liked the Patrice Evra video after the United game on Twitter to bring a case against him.
They want to freeze him out of the squad because he liked Patrice Evra's.
So they froze him already. They've frozen him from the squad. I think they want to sack him.
Because he liked Patrice Evra.
And also because he went partying in a nightclub in Paris the night of the United defeat at the Parc des Princes.
Right.
And him and his mum says, listen, you don't play me. I can't even come and train at the
So they're not playing his mother either.
No, but and Rabiot saying, I can do what I want. I'm not a football player anymore. I think the mum wouldn't be fine in her interview, but she said he's a prisoner. They are preventing from playing football, right, which he just wants to do his job. He's a hostage of PSG. They're strong words when you think about other
she
things
said
happening in the world.
They'll put him on bread and water soon.
Yes, and he's on 250k a week that they still
£250k
a month that they still pay.
Yeah,
some of the best bread as well.
Yeah. Feel French the pain. Bread. So, Jules, this surely is an untenable situation. Will he not move in the summer?
He's out of contract anyway. That's the key of the problem, is that he didn't want to renew the deal, they've frozen him out because of that, although Tuchel wanted him.
Well, it's only a couple of months then.
Yeah. I can understand why they're frustrated and why it's not a good situation for him and for the mum, who is his agent. But there's not much more, like you said, to go. And then he'll be free to sign wherever he wants.
Okay. Antoine Griezmann, is he going to sign for Man United? Because there was a paper saying that this week. Jules?
There was. He's questioning what to do next. That doesn't mean he's not going to stay at Atletico, but I think he was very disappointed by the defeat at Juventus. But not just the defeat, I think the way they planned the game and the way they played the game. And I think he would stay.
You think he'll stay at Atletico? Definitely. Do you know what I'm going to do next?
What?
I'm going to go home and watch Antoine Griezmann, The Making of a Legend.
Have you watched The Decision first?
No, I haven't watched The Decision. I need to watch that before I watch. These are Antoine Griezmann.
One will inform the other.
Okay.
You'll probably maybe get 2 minutes into The Decision and then decide not to watch the next one.
But what is The Making of a Legend is about him, yeah?
Yes, it's his whole own Netflix documentary.
To me, that sounds quite unprecedented for an active player to basically... I mean, Messi's not done one. Cristiano Ronaldo's not done
Sergio Ramos is doing one at the moment.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh, hence the film crew.
Yeah. Mm. So it's the new thing. There's going to be cameramen on pitch at some point in the next 5 years, I think, following players around, going, get the striker out of the way. My boy needs to get on the end of this cross.
Yeah. It's a chilling vision of the future, Duncan.
The tough thing is he got absolutely slaughtered for The Decision documentary, which I believe only LeBron James had ever done before. So... it was quite easy for everyone to compare. You're not LeBron James. You will never be as close as what LeBron James was to basketball than what you could be to football. So why? And then he just waits for a year, less than that, 6 months. And then he thinks like, do you know what? The decision
He's
was so good.
In The Decision, if anything.
That I'm going to do even better, bigger than that. I'm going to do like a whole documentary about myself.
Well, he has won a World Cup, I guess, in the meantime.
Yeah. And maybe he thinks that's enough to be called a legend and to do this, but like you said, even the biggest of goats have never done it.
Well, quite.
But I'm waiting to see. I'm waiting to watch it and then judge by myself. But it's a big call.
Paul Pogba gave everybody in the France World Cup squad NBA championship style rings. How much did he spend?
Oh, we don't know yet. I was told it's around $20,000 each.
$20,000 each.
Yeah.
How many players in the squad?
23.
Well, you do the math, listener.
It's a lot of money. The very interesting thing...
Duncan, what's the answer?
We're approaching half a million euros, dollars, whatever.
Some of the players, and I won't say names, were not so convinced about the idea. So Griezmann came up with the idea. Griezmann did that for himself and just for him after winning the Europa League. I know. So he created his own ring after winning the Europa League.
That's the decision.
Because him and Pogba are huge NBA fans or American sports fans, and you know. Uh-huh. So Griezmann came up with the idea, and there was a few of the boys in the squad that were not so keen on spending 20 or 30, whatever, on a ring to celebrate the World Cup win. So then Pogba said, okay, don't worry, I'll pay for everything. The French mm-hmm. Federation paid for the transportation from LA to Paris, which cost 10,000 euros just to transport the 23 rings. And then on Tuesday night, Pogba had a little ceremony with Griezmann to give the ring to the 17 players who are currently in the squad who were there in the World Cup. Mm-hmm. So six are not there: Rami, Dembele, Nzonzi, Mendy, Lucas Hernandez, and someone else. So they've missed out. They still have the ring, but not to them. And none of the staff, Deschamps was not invited. Deschamps didn't even know that they gave the ring on Tuesday night. It's only on Wednesday morning that he learned about it. Deschamps thinks it's a good thing because he will even bring those guys together even more. And that the guys who...
One ring to bring...
Yeah. And the ones who were not at the World Cup would want to win to get similar rings, because I think it's something they will do now if they keep winning. But yeah, it's grand, to say the least. If you haven't seen the rings, they're everywhere now on social media, but there's a lot of diamonds on them, names of the players, all the games that they played, Russia 2018, world champions written on them, etc.
I was going to say England didn't do this when they won the World Cup in 66, but then they did run into their own jewellery-based issues a couple of years later, didn't they?
Right, thanks for that, Duncan. Didn't mention that it was Griezmann's birthday today, Jules.
Yeah, joyeux anniversaire, Antoine.
All right, I wonder how he's going to be celebrating.
So he would have a cake, because that's what they do when they're together in the national team. So they have a big cake.
Will he eat it all himself?
So yeah, he will bake it and eat it by himself. Yeah, and they'll have a little party, but nothing.
Okay. Nothing. It's an auspicious day for footballers, because Ronaldinho is also an age today. And Lothar Matthäus.
Wow. It's a big day. What?
21st of March. What are you doing today, Jules, this evening?
I'm commentating from French radio on Chelsea PSG in the first leg of the Women's Champions League quarterfinals.
Oh,
tonight,
really?
At Kingsmead, in Kingston upon Thames. If you're there, I'll be there too. And it's quite an exciting game, to be fair.
But yeah.
Between the English champions and PSG, who are trying to get there with the top teams in Europe.
Right. Much as their male counterparts.
Yeah. I mean,
how much are PSG pushing this?
They are. It's a big budget. I think 10 million euros is the budget for the season for the women's team. They've got very good youngsters, French youngsters, coming through. They also have Wang, for example, the Chinese playmaker, who is very good. The problem they have is that Lyon has been so good and is so ahead of his time for women's football, and has been for 10 years. That is PSG is playing catch-up with them, and they're trying to get there. But it's an exciting game, and Lyon beat Wolfsburg 2-1 yesterday in one of the other quarterfinals. I think there's Slavia Prague, who, by the way, we mentioned in the Europa League, also in the quarterfinals of the Women's Champions League. They have a very good women's team as well. So Bayern Munich, Barcelona. So it's a good competition, and tonight should be a good game.
Right. Interesting twist that the women's game, the men's game, that in the women's game, PSG are chasing Lyon, not the other way around, and they're also still in the Champions League.
They are.
James, you wanted to...
Yeah, I should also say that this weekend there is a top-of-the-table clash in the Serie A Women's Championship between Juventus and Fiorentina, which will probably feature Enya Luko and Lana Cleland. And it's being played at the Allianz Stadium as well.
Nice.
I think entry is free as well. So,
well, a week on from that 60,000-plus crowd in Madrid. It'd be interesting to see the turnout for
and
that.
I was a bit disappointed, just to finish on that, that the Chelsea PSG was not at Stamford Bridge, I have to say. And I know they play their home games at Kingsmead, and it's a nice little stadium. But
what's
I think for a game
there?
Like that, 4,600, only 2,000 of seated places.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsors of Melchester Rovers. Find out more at RoyTheRoversOfficial.com.
Italy, home games coming up against Finland and Liechtenstein for Roberto Mancini's Azzurri, who've only had 3 wins in his 9 matches in charge. But there's a lot of positivity around this side, because a bit like England, Duncan, there's a promising new generation there. You've got your Enrico Chiesas, although there's an injury scare over him.
Federico Chiesas, because Enrico wouldn't be very young anymore.
Wouldn't be very young. Federico Chiesas. You've got Zaniolo, Barilla, Romagnoli.
I mean, Moise Kean.
A lot of exciting new talent in there. The midfield's very exciting. Verratti,
Jorginho,
and Jorginho and Zaniolo now going into that mix as well. Barella.
Yeah, I think it's going back to November. It seemed very difficult to move beyond the midfield three that he had settled on, which was very much Barella, Jorginho, and Verratti, because they were the reason that a lot of people were getting very excited. They seemed to mesh very well, very quickly. But he's got so many options, and of course we've seen with Zaniolo, someone who's very flexible, has played in a number of different positions for Roma. He's played as a 10, he's played on the wing, he's played in midfield, either as a 6 or an 8. So you know, I think there's a lot of options there. And of course, one of the reasons why Balotelli's not in, James, is because a certain 36-year-old striker is top of the scoring charts at the moment, Fabio Quagliarella, who completely deserves to be there, and is someone who does have that kind of technical proficiency to combine with, you know, a couple of technical wingers in a way that maybe Balotelli doesn't. Right. So, yeah, I think quite excited to see Quagliarella back in the starting level for the first time really since Italy went out of the World Cup in 2010.
Good Lord.
They're on full merit as well.
We'll be talking about the Italian national side in Golazzo this week, which is a very busy show because it's also got full story and picks on the extraordinary Vittorio Cecchigori and all the crazy things that went on during his reign at Fiorentina. And we also touch on one of the really intriguing tales that's kind of breaking at the moment. The American takeover of Sampdoria with prospectively Gianluca Vialli becoming president. Now, we didn't have any confirmation yesterday. Today, there's been a little bit more word on this. It does seem like this is a real thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And this has been rumbling on for some time. I think there are maybe some parallels with the Cecchigori case at Fiorentina and Massimo Ferrero at Sampdoria. I think it's maybe about time that this club came under stable ownership, even though the people he surrounded himself in terms of football expertise have done actually a very good job in terms of appointing managers, signing players. But yeah, would be very positive, I think, to see Sampdoria taken over by an American group which seems to have very, very solid foundations and bright ideas as well.
And Vialli back at Samp.
Yeah.
That'd be fantastic.
Well, also, Vialli has been asked to be a part of Roberto Mancini's not backroom staff, but be a director for the Italian Football Federation. I think one of the reasons he has postponed making a decision on that is because he wants to see where this takeover leads. And it does look like it's leading to him becoming the next president of Sampdoria.
International week, and that means listener questions. Here's Guy, Guy Lecon. Perhaps Guy. He says, which team, I like this question, outside of the Big Six, has the best long-term chance of escaping the Everton Cup and consistently competing for the much-coveted Champions League places? And conversely, which of the current Big Six is most likely to drop into regular Everton Cup contention? What do you think, Jules?
That's a very good question, Guy. I think Wolves, obviously, have been the surprise package of the season.
Uh-huh. And who do you see coming down?
I go for Chelsea.
Really?
I think they're in a real mess.
Really?
Yeah.
James?
Yeah, I think if you look at the limits that are going to be placed on Chelsea, unless they can overturn the transfer ban, the issues with star players and their contracts running down and wanting to move on, and the owner's situation as well, you know, whether he is as committed and prepared to put in money as he once was, because we've all seen Chelsea move to a self-sustainable model. I think to some extent a lot will depend on the situation with Pochettino at Spurs. Were Pochettino to leave, which I think is becoming more and more unlikely, you know, that might have an impact on them, particularly given that they've built a new stadium and all of the money that has taken up. But in terms of getting into the top six and replacing one of them, I think probably Wolves have the better backing and the manager at the moment.
Duncan, are you going to say Chelsea and Wolves?
No, I'm going to say Tottenham, much for the reasons James has outlined. And also coming up, Leicester. I think they've got a really good youth policy. They've got a new manager. They've got, like, is it the 14th biggest wage bill in the world? You know, they pay a lot. And I think they've got, you know, potential to go back in the top four.
All right. Nice one, Guy. Also in the postbag this week, Cornish Weather says, please never play Cher again without ample warning. I ended up at a set of busy traffic lights with people and school kids crossing in the van with her blasting out the open windows. total loss of credibility. Sorry about that, Cornish weather. Warren says, Australia moved to the Asian Federation to become more competitive. Which nation would the esteemed panel like to see play in the UEFA Association from outside on a regular basis? You got a nation you'd like to see drop into the Euros?
Well, we can pick anyone, even like...
That's the question, yeah.
I'll go for Brazil,
Qatar.
Argentina.
Okay.
Brazil.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Brazil. Hit me with a left field choice.
Brazil are halfway there, aren't they? I mean, they play games at Loftus Road and Craven Cottage and stuff.
It's like the Copa America this year. We'll have Qatar in there, Japan.
Yep.
Maybe the Euros should do the same
Japan,
and just invite
like Japan in there.
Just invite, invite
not
other
least
countries.
For the stadiums after spick and span.
Just invite other countries. Yeah.
Need to clean up your dressing room.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, Christopher Veland or Violand potentially. Christopher anyway says thank you for reporting on MLS and Rooney's hat trick. May I direct your attention to FC Cincinnati? Yes, James?
Well, no, we've just gone from Japan to MLS.
Oh, yeah.
And it's quite interesting. You look at Vissel Kobe, who've been able to get, like, Iniesta, David Villa, Torres now plays in Japan. And one of the reasons that they're choosing Japan over MLS is because in MLS, a lot of the pitches are sort of astroturfy, 3G. There's a lot more travelling involved. And, you know, outside of New York or LA, where do you want to go and play, really? Where's Japan? You know,
everything's... Cincinnati?
Yeah, but, I mean, James, would you move to Cincinnati to do this podcast? I've got a friend who lives in Cincinnati and commutes from Chicago. But, I
really?
I'm sure it's a great place. But
radio's great there. Am I right, 80s fans?
But Japan, James, yeah. I mean, you can go everywhere by train, proper pitches.
Oh, no, sure. If they're offering to do the podcast in Japan, I'd definitely... I'd definitely consider that.
There.
Yeah. But anyway, so back to Christopher, directing your attention to FC Cincinnati, which is a new franchise, winning their MLS home opener against Portland, who are only the defending Western Conference champions. 3-0 it was. And the second goal, as Christopher points out, was an absolute belter.
Lamar holds it up. Maddox making the run. Forced to turn around by Diallo. Back for Lamar. Rolling Lamar. Deflected ball. Alan Cruz back.
Well, there you go. Denim John, sorry if your windows were down, by the way, man in the van. Denim John says, I know it's International Weekend, and I know you ever look at the Premier League, City, our National League, and World's Strongest Man League tables, but treat yourself to looking at the lower half of League One, if you haven't already. It's unbelievable, this, says Denim John. Duncan.
Well, as a erstwhile Wickham supporter, I'm alarmed, because we haven't won for 8 or 9 games, and we are... being sucked ever downward towards the relegation zone.
It's a 13-team relegation battle. There are 13 teams all within 4 points of the drop. In the lower half of the table, which Denim John was just mentioning, 12 teams within 6 points of each other from 13th to bottom. So big games coming up this weekend as well. I'm not sure who Wickham have got.
We were supposed to be playing Charlton, but that's been postponed for international call-ups from Charlton. I presume Jonathan Johansson and Mark Fish, but I haven't checked. We could... Obviously, not playing means nil pois, so we could go further down. So.
Damn. Okay. Anyway, best luck to everyone concerned there with the League One relegation battle. Lots of people responding to Flip Reverse, our exciting Jules new segment in which we reverse engineer football history. We right some wrongs. We had Daniel Storey talking about the 1991 FA Cup final on Monday.
Oh yeah, I did 2006 World Cup final, didn't I?
Yeah, you did, but you kind of we didn't really give it the full Flip Reverse.
Oh, okay.
Feel free to come back with another French defeat or PSG disappointment.
Because
I can't.
There's enough to choose from.
On another occasion, because today is all about Duncan's choice. Okay. Selbridge Gunner says 1991 Cup final, not a bad choice, but the ultimate flip reverse it would be the quarter final of the Champions League between Arsenal and Chelsea in 2004.
I agree. Arsenal, I was there, I agree.
I considered that one.
Arsenal held on to the halftime. If Arsenal hold on to their halftime lead and beat Monaco in the semis and Mourinho's Porto in the final, Mourinho never makes it to the Premier League. Was that your ramification?
But also Wenger would have, you know, won the Champions League, and the Invincibles would be more reasonably called the Invincibles.
I see. LD says, in a twist on Flip Reverse It, which one managerial change would you prevent in history? Well, there you go. That's an avenue we could go down. LD mentions Bobby Robson replacing Souness, which started the Newcastle wild ride into Ashleyism. Well, I tell you, the possibilities are endless. But we'll be playing today's designated historical incident of Flip Reverse It after this. Thanks, Blazing Squad. It's time once again to meddle with things we don't understand and march back in time to redo a game that we're just not happy with. Mind those ripples in the space-time continuum. Duncan Alexander, as you take us back to when?
September 1992.
Oh, right, hence the snap earlier.
Yeah, exactly. And it was 1-0 to Manchester United, and it was the match where Dion Dublin broke his leg.
No complaints from Manchester United about the Eric Young challenge that so cruelly cut into Dion Dublin's first season with them and left Alex Ferguson facing an imminent European campaign with just 8 fit Englishmen. A broken leg and a dis ankle cast a sad shadow over Wednesday's game.
The broken leg is one thing, Duncan, but that dis ankle...
If you dis your ankle, then, yeah, it's bad.
Interesting to see Dion Dublin's sporting apparently a moustache in those days. I don't recall that.
It was September 1992.
It was. People
it was all
did different things.
Yeah.
Did you have a tash then, James?
No, I didn't.
No.
No.
Shame.
We could easily say Crystal Palace win the game, that's enough points at the end of the season for them to stay up. But obviously, if Dion Dublin doesn't break his leg, it's unlikely that United then, a month or so later, go and sign Eric Cantona from Leeds, which obviously is the big catalyst for then what happens for not only that season, but following seasons. And it's quite common when you reimagine United without Ferguson, whatever, to go back to the Mark Robins game in 1990. But I think the difference with doing it at this point is that we're far enough along that I think what it would have done was really affect the class of 92, and I don't think a lot of them would have necessarily come through. Because if you think Ferguson, he gets that end of that season, Aston Villa win the league. Who's the manager of Aston Villa? Ron Atkinson. Who's their star player? Got player of the season, Paul McGrath, both ex-United. The thing there would have been, oh look, United again have screwed things up. Their old manager's won the league, we should have kept him, blah, blah, blah. And they wouldn't have signed Roy Keane at the end of that season. He'd have probably chosen Blackburn, which was his choice. So I think it would have really had a massive tangible effect on
But could Dion Dublin not have performed the same role as Eric Cantona in this Cantona-less universe?
I think not. That's not to take anything away from Dion Dublin. He then went on to have a good Premier League career with Coventry and Villa.
And invent a percussion instrument.
Exactly.
Even better career on Holmes Under the Hammer as well.
Indeed.
But I thought the game was to flip reverse something for a better ending. You wouldn't want the best thing that ever happened to English football not to happen.
Well, I think there's a better ending if you're a supporter of Newcastle United, if you're a supporter of Liverpool. I think Liverpool would have 2 or 3 Premier League titles. Newcastle would have probably dominated the mid-90s. Blackburn might have won a couple of leagues. Aston Villa would have won a league. I think in terms of kind of egalitarianism, it would have been a better move.
Fair enough.
That's interesting. What would have happened to Eric Cantona languishing at Leeds?
But maybe in the same way. Maybe in the same way Leeds would have become the United.
And a generation of young Leeds players would have become the owners of Salford.
Exactly, because remember David O'Leary's Babes. You know, if he just hung on a little bit longer, he would have brought those Babes through.
Yeah,
incredible.
Yeah,
wow. Okay, which universe would you rather live in, Duncan?
another universe.
Just anyone.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a big shout, but I'm hearing you. All right. Well, on that note, let's get the odds on some of this weekend's exciting set of internationals. Here's producer Ben talking to Paddy Power.
Yes, listeners, it's your favourite part of the show. It's that time when I speak to Lee Price from Paddy Power. Lee, it's International Week. I'm excited. You must be too. Let's talk about England versus the Czech Republic to start with. I have a feeling that Harry Kane is going to score and one of Jadon Sancho and Callum Hudson-Odoi is going to too. What sort of price can I get on that one, please?
Well, I don't want to sound like I'm stuck in the summer of 2018, but very confident. Both scenarios you outlined are 4-1. Harry Kane, of course, odds on score anytime, like he is in most matches. That's 4-6. And we like the chance of Sancho and Hudson-Odoi too. Both for the same price, 23-10 to score against the Czechs. And I have to say, the betting for England generally is more buoyant than Harry Maguire on an inflatable unicorn. They're 1-5 to win this match. What could possibly go wrong?
Really interesting chat with Simon Cooper earlier on in the show. So give us the numbers, please, for Holland beating Germany.
Yeah, Germany going for a rough patch, aren't they? I was going to say it's always nice to see that, but I can't remember the last time we did see a dip like this. It was almost 20 years ago, of course, but they are dipping and Holland are going in the opposite direction. So we make it 5-4 that Holland remain on a high in Amsterdam. They're our favourites for this. While it's 13-8, Germany given the red light with an away win. The draw, which I always think is massive value in these tight games, is 9-4.
And finally, Lee, with apologies to all of our friends at the Totally Scottish Football Show, can San Marino score against the Tartan Army?
Could be a risk, I suppose. Scotland are running out of left-backs, but they're not always the greatest help against San Marino, just our Stuart Pearce. Scotland are 1-100 to win this game. San Marino, our longest-priced team, to win this international break at 40-1. Just to score, though, is more likely, of course, for San Marino. It's 6-4 that they get on the score sheet. Quite hard to imagine.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com. All prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's 18 plus only. BeGambleAware.org. And when the fun stops, stop. Monday's Totally Football Show, we'll see Michael Cox joining us alongside Daniel Story and Jack Lang. So if you have a question sparked by today's edition, do send it in, because I feel there may be time to respond to it and more. What are you going to do this weekend, James?
I'm going to watch Milan-San Remo, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Saturday afternoon, yeah.
Mm, right. Duncan, what's your weekend hold?
Similar to James, I'll be watching that. And as we said earlier, I'm going to England, Czech Republic
on Friday.
So
that's going to be huge.
Enormous.
Going to be huge. And you, Jules?
And I go to France, Iceland on Monday night.
In Paris?
In Paris, indeed, at the Stade de France.
Well, that'll be lovely.
Jules didn't fancy Moldova.
No, away.
Picks neither and chooses his games.
Neither did my family, to be fair.
Right. Excellent. All right, well, listen, whatever you get up to in the next few days, do have a splendid time, and we'll catch up with you on Monday. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com, and don't forget to check out our other football podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand. Supporting your team can be a beautiful thing, but then come the injuries, the goal droughts, and the downright disastrous defeats. That's a little bit like life, really, and here at the Totally Football Show, we believe we should all support each other the way we support our team, through the good days and the bad. And that's why we're continuing to work with CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably, a charity dedicated to preventing male suicide. On average, 12 men take their own life every day in the UK, so that's your starting 11 and your manager every single day. And part of the problem is that many of us still feel uncomfortable talking about mental health and suicide, and this can often stop men from opening up and getting support when they need it the most. So if you're worried that someone close to you is having a tough time, check in with them and let them know that CALM is there. Every day from 5pm till midnight, CALM provide a free, confidential and anonymous helpline and web chat for any man who needs support. Visit thecalmzone.net to find out more about CALM.